Sylvia Earle. Just to me is, you know, her deepness to everybody, her Sturgeon General. She has inspired me more than she will ever know. I really became a journalist because I could not be a marine biologist, so therefore I said I'm going to write about it, and it's all because of this lady here. You know, she has been an aquanaut before anybody, any other woman ever thought about this. And because of that, she's been called Sturgeon General and her deepness. For me, it's just simply wonderful, Sylvia Earle. Her Mission Blue Alliance wants to inspire awareness for the established protected areas globally. But more than that, she's the epitome of what it means to be a woman explorer, also explorer in residence of National Geographic. So I am honored to have you, Sylvia.
Thank you. Thank you. Huh. I'm a little bit out of breath because I've just raced here from West Palm Beach and the Loggerhead Center for, well, it's a marine science center, but they take care of turtles. So from turtles to you. And I have brought a few images to help sweeten the message. This first one is one that I just look at every once in a while to remind myself where we are. It's that view of Earth from way out in the solar system. This is Carl Sagan's pale blue dot. Next one, please. A little closer. Still a bit of a speck in the universe. But, you know, it's the first time in all of human history that we've been able to see ourselves this way during the lifetime of people here, myself included. All preceding history, we probably knew something about what are those sparkly things out in the sky, but we're one of them. We're one of those little dots. And this is the only little dot that's suitable for us. What a concept. I mean, yes, I love science fiction and the idea of going to Mars and setting up housekeeping. I would love to go and see how the red planet functions. But meanwhile, we don't even know how the blue one functions. We know better today than we did 50 years ago. We now know that there are limits to what we can get away with and still have a hospitable place that we call home. I think that's pretty exciting news. I still get inspired just with that special photograph. Next, please. To me, with all due respect to the National Geographic, this is the most powerful photograph that's ever been taken. This is actually, I think, a composite that takes the clouds away, but it's the real deal. As a kid, I had a globe that didn't show what was under the blue. In fact, until fairly recently, most maps, and some maps still just show the ocean as a big blob of blue. And I had a chance in 2006 at a conference in Spain where John Hankey, who heads Google Earth, was called Keyhole before it was acquired by Google, and tell him how much I love Google because I can see my backyard, I can see my neighbor's backyard, I can fly the Grand Canyon, I can find Starbucks, I can go all over the place. My kids love it, my grandkids love it, best video game in town. But it just popped out. I didn't intend to say it, but I said, I hope someday, John, you'll finish it. You've done a great job with the land, but you should call it Google Dirt because the ocean is missing. But it's not missing anymore. We now have the ocean in Google Earth, and you can fly around and see. I'm going to show you a sample after I show you some other images. But think about it. 5 years ago, we couldn't do that. Today, we're armed with more capacity to understand the nature of the world and what's happening to it. Next, please. We can now see, actually, this has been possible for some years, that the sands of Africa fly across the Atlantic, and they're dusting the atmosphere that we're breathing right here, right now. Next, please. Just to show how things are connected, we could not do that. There was so much that we didn't know. And we made policies, decisions. We have attitudes based on not knowing some of the basic matters of living. Rachel Carson, in 1951, in The Sea Around Us, a book that as a kid I devoured, I thought, this is it. This book tells me kind of the essence of what we know about the ocean. And I found it mesmerizing. But she did not know in 1951 that the continents move around, did not know about plate tectonics or the existence of the great mountain chains down the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Ocean, didn't know that the ocean actually had life at the greatest depth, because we hadn't been there, didn't get there till 1960. Nobody has been back since. Huh. Another part of what makes this time so amazing, what we've accomplished and what we haven't accomplished, all in one mix here at the beginning of the 21st century. Rachel Carson, in The Sea Around Us, remarked on how much the land had changed owing to human activity, but she said what most people at the time thought, that we had no power to change the ocean, that the ocean is so big, so vast, so resilient. The policies that were made here in this country about fishing in the 1960s, the 70s, and even up to the present time are really geared with a Lewis and Clark kind of attitude, that there are, quotes, resources out there to be acquired, that it is our job to not clear-cut the forests, but clear-cut the fish, not bring back the skins of animals, but we bring back the whole animals, if you will, and extract the goods. Mining from the ocean is right on the edge, the cusp of really expanding right now. It's been put off for some time because of the difficulty of getting to the deep sea, where some important, quotes, resources are known to exist. But the cost and the difficulty of getting there has held us back until right about now. This is the moment, as never before in history, when we look at the planet with new eyes and we're at a crossroads. Either we take the same attitude, the same policies, the same approaches we've used over all preceding human history toward the land and apply it to the ocean, or we can learn from what works and what doesn't work from the land, that maybe mountaintop removal to get to the coal isn't such a good idea. We have a chance to start over in the ocean, maybe clear-cutting the bottom of the ocean to get to some of the rare minerals that may exist in the crusts around hydrothermal vents may not be such a good idea. But whatever it is, let's go check it out first. Let's explore before we exploit. That's an idea worth thinking about and acting on. Let's look first and then leap, instead of just assuming that it's all there and all infinite in its capacity to be used, no matter and without consequences back to us. Next, please. Ha! Now we know about the connection between the ocean and the atmosphere and the consequences to us in ways that we couldn't imagine when I was a kid. So much has changed. So much has been learned. We've literally learned more since the middle of the 20th century about the nature, not just of the ocean, but the nature of nature writ large. How does the world work? How do things connect? More than during all preceding history. At the same time, I think it's fair to say that we have lost more, changed more through our actions in that same incredible piece of time that all of us here have been a part of. Next, please. Well, I, as a kid, loved going to the beach. I got smashed by a wave in New Jersey when I was 3 years old, fell in love with the ocean, came to Florida, spent my later next years from 12 onward for even now on the Gulf Coast of Florida. Next, please. But I took the leap, like I hope, if not all of you, enough of you to get the rest of you inspired. My mother waited until she was 81, and she would say, if she could be here, don't wait until you're 81. Do it now. Do it as soon as you can. Go see the ocean. See the blue planet from the inside out. So after she had seen it, she scolded me for not getting her there sooner. So I hope that if you don't like to get wet, then get a submarine. But go see the ocean. Don't miss out. Next, please. Next. Or maybe you can hitch a ride in one of the very few underwater laboratories that exist. Actually, I only know of two that still exist, and both of them are in the Florida Keys. One is in Key Largo. You can check in and spend the night down in Key Largo as an underwater hotel, or as a scientist, or a journalist, or sometimes kids have actually had a chance to at least visit. You can get a passport to go see the Aquarius, and maybe stay in the Aquarius. I've had a chance to live underwater 9 different times, and it really changed the way I think about the ocean. Diving has done that, of course, but it's the gift of time, the ability to stay day and night for days, even weeks. I spent some time in the Florida Keys with Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, for one of his programs, and he called it the fish's neighborhood. And I, in a way, next slide please, kind of got to see it through his eyes in that way, being able to explore and to go deeper into the ocean. They're one of the several submarines that are now out there. I do long for Hertz Rent-A-Sub. It doesn't exist yet, but there are more and more little subs that are available, so simple to drive that even a scientist can do it. I'm living proof. Next, please. You know, and this little creature, I had a chance to use it back in 1979. Looks like an astronaut suit, but it's a hard suit instead of a soft suit. And it, too, inspired me to think about going deeper than I can go, holding my breath, stay longer than I can go with scuba. This is the so-called gym suit, J-I-M, named after the first person willing to put it on. Next, please. This is one of the little deep worker subs. There are about 20 of them. They go to 2,000 feet. There are a number that are now being built for yachts, for heaven's sakes. So why not for scientists? Why not for journalists? Why not for anybody who wants to take a Saturday afternoon and go cruise off in your underwater sports car? Next, please. And visit with a fish. Get to see them swimming in something other than lemon slices and butter. I mean, most people only know fish in pieces. They don't see the whole thing, especially not on their own terms. Next, please. Spending thousands of hours actually in the fish's neighborhood, I've had a chance to think differently about them and to see them with new eyes. Everybody knows that there aren't any two people, even so-called identical twins or triplets or quadruplets, exactly alike. But it took me being in the water for long periods of time, getting acquainted with these creatures face to face, to realize they do have a face, and that everyone is different, and they behave differently. Every grouper, they may taste the same in a sandwich, but they don't behave the same out there in the ocean. Next, please. You know it about cats and dogs and horses and kids. But fish? Next, please. You open up a can of sardines, and of course they all look alike, and they sort of taste alike and all that. But in the ocean, those who go and really spend time there really understand the immense capacity for diversity among individual species, as well as, of course, the diversity of life writ large. Next, please. So, don't shortchange yourself and your life. Like my recipe for education for kids, no child left dry. It should apply to journalists as well. No journalist, no writer, no person. Why stay dry? Most of the planet is wet. Most of life on Earth is wet. Why are we, you know, sitting here on the top when 97% of the biosphere is ocean? It's where 97% of water is. And when people say, I've never seen the ocean, I don't care about the ocean, so why should I care about what happens there? And I ask, do you like to breathe? Do you like to take a bath? Do you like water? Do you like to drink? Do you like a planet that has a temperature range that's just right for us? Of course, it's partly the distance from the sun, but it's also the fact that this is a water planet, stabilizes temperature, generates most of the oxygen in the atmosphere, grabs most of the carbon dioxide and stores it. It drives all the cycles that we care about. You know, the cycle of life, basically, is anchored, first of all, in water, and that means ocean. Next, please. I just love looking at the faces of fish. And if you just really don't like to get wet, then go to one of those halfway houses for fish called aquariums. They're pretty good, fish and people. Next, please. Because although you can't see a giant school of golden rays such as this, and you might if you go out to the ocean, next, please, you certainly can see schools of fish in a tank and really look carefully. No two sets of stripes exactly alike. No two faces, and they don't behave the same either. Next, please. And when you take one out of the system, you leave a hole. A unique place is then opened, just as with human beings. When one of us goes out of the system, there's a hole that's left, and it's true with social structures and ecosystems in the ocean as well. Next, please. So ask any eel. Next, please. Or turtle. They have faces, too. And everyone, next, please, is unique. Next, please. We don't really think about that when we promote fishing. I was listening with great interest to the previous speaker about how do we change attitudes about the way we take wildlife from the sea. We don't even call it wildlife, we call it seafood. I don't call it seafood, I call it sea life. We eat sea life. It's not all food, even those things that we consume. Well, tuna is good for a lot of things, and yes, they taste good, but tuna are important to the way the ocean works. We should be valuing, just as we value whales for more than just pounds of meat and barrels of oil, we should be thinking about wildlife, again, in the broader sense of how they affect the nature of the ocean. Next, please. If anyone could actually get up close and observe and be a part of the action and see how we treat the ocean, using crude techniques to scrape the ocean floor to get things we love to eat, like popcorn shrimp. Or if you've seen Forrest Gump, there are about 1,010 ways that we can prepare shrimp, like chicken. But they're wild, and except for those that are now cultivated, but there's a wild cost to that too, because we take wild creatures to grind up and make food to feed to the shrimp, or to salmon, or to other farmed animals, including cows, chickens, and pigs. We grind up fish that are caught from the sea to make these tasty little morsels that are part of what we then consume. Next, please. But it's not working. It isn't. We're too good in some ways about finding and extracting and marketing wildlife from the blue part of the planet. This is China, but it could be the Gulf of Mexico or the North Sea or the coast of Australia or you name it. Coastal waters everywhere are being stripped of whatever can be scraped from the bottom of the sea. Next. Here, just off of Florida, the cost is not really accounted for. We think that fish, they used to be when I was a kid, cheap. The cheapest thing you could get to eat, cheapest protein was fish because they were free. You just had to go out and catch them. Well, now we know we're beginning to figure out the real cost of so-called cheap wildlife from the sea, cheap energy from the sea, quotes around that cheap business, because none of this has properly been accounted for. I think that's part of your challenge, to really do the heavy lifting, figure it out. What is the real cost of a barrel of oil taken from the sea? What is the real cost of fish that are extracted when you leave behind destruction, like those coral reefs that may never recover? But some of them are still intact, so there's hope, because those that are still intact can serve as sources of renewal for those that have been destroyed. But it takes a long time for these deep-sea corals to recover. Next, please. This is in the southern hemisphere near New Zealand, orange roughy being extracted in large quantities. As a kid, orange roughy wasn't on anybody's menu except maybe some deep sea sharks. We have only acquired the access, equipment, the ability to get to the deep sea in recent years, about the last 30 years or so. But nobody thinks that $8.95 is the right price or the wrong price. They think, well, of course, it's there. It's good. It's good protein. But the real cost of the fish that sells in my local market in Oakland, California, for $8.95 a pound, has to be measured in the cost of the corals, the 2,000-year-old corals that are stripped down in order to get these fish, or the fish themselves that take 30 years to mature. Anybody here ever think about eating 30-year-old chickens or cows or pigs or whatever? We get them to market as fast as possible. Usually within a year, sometimes a little longer. Catfish, tilapia, carp, the pretty good choices for fish to consume. Because for one thing, they not only grow fast, and they don't mind being crowded, and they're hardy, and they taste good, but they're also low on the food chain. They eat plants. Orange roughy don't eat plants. They're carnivores, like most of the fish we eat. And there's a big tail of bycatch that goes with any of these big old fish that we consume. Grouper, snapper, cod, swordfish, you know, what do you like to eat? They're top of the food chain. And they have eaten fish that have eaten fish that have eaten other fish that ultimately eat these little shrimpy things that eat the plants. And it's a long and twisty food chain that results in, well, look at it. Look at any of you. How much, if you thought of all the groceries that have been invested in you, or you, or you in your lifetime, there they are. That's what it has taken to make whatever poundage you walk around with today. So you've got a 20-year-old tuna. How much has that tuna eaten in its lifetime? That's the real accounting. Farmers account for how much hay, how much food, how much whatever it is it takes to grow a cow. But we don't even think about what it takes to make a tuna. But we should. Next, please. That's a little orange roughy. Most people never see the whole fish. Next. All over the world. This is Tasmania, but it could be New Orleans, it could be New York, it could be San Francisco or Tokyo or London. People love to eat wildlife. You open up the menu at the restaurant, and there you've got usually chicken, pork, beef, and then there's this list of wildlife. They don't have snow leopard and elephant and rhinoceros and eagles and owls, but we've got wild fish. We've got wild squid, calamari, wild animals right there for us to choose from. Think about it. Really? What are we doing to our blue planet? Next, please. Sharks. When I started diving in 1953, I was told, watch out, there are man-eaters out there. And then I thought about it. I don't really have to worry if they're just man-eaters. And that held me in good stead for a long time. And more people get in the water, they realize sharks are really, we're not on their menu. But boy, are sharks on ours, increasingly, so that only about 10% of the sharks in the world remain. Maybe the deep sea species are in better shape, but those that we come in contact with in most of our operations in the sea, they've been blitzed. Next, please. We know how to kill them. We know how to prepare them in shark fin soup, in the macho meal that we see as shark steak, thrasher, occasionally you'll see blue shark. Next, please, on the menu. But mostly it's the fins now that are driving the market for sharks. Good news in California just last week, ta-da, Governor Brown signed into law protection for sharks. You can't trade in sharks in California. It's happening as a kind of a wave. Hawaii did this a few months ago. Palau has declared their waters safe for sharks. It's a turnaround. I know Peter Benchley apologized for sharks for most of his life after writing Jaws. That got a lot of people to think they were doing something good to kill a shark. The only good shark is a dead shark, right? Well, the best shark is a live shark. They're part of what makes the ocean function, like eagles and owls and other top predators. They're really important. They've been around for more than 300 million years, and we think it's a good thing to get rid of them if we want a planet that works. Next. Tunas? Well, again, why can't we look at these creatures with new eyes now that we have the power to do so? Of course, sushi and sashimi, again, something that has developed in the last few decades from nothing, except in a few places in Asia, especially Japan, to the rage, all the rage, raw fish. Next, please. But I have heard MIT engineers literally sigh with envy when they see a bluefin tuna, because we can't do what they do, power our way through the ocean, collecting, actually capturing 97% of the energy generated. Next, please. Or whales. Next, please. Once looked at as commodities. Next, please. Still looked at in some places as commodities, food. Next, please. Even dolphins, beloved around most of the world, but still regarded as commodities in a few places. Next, please. Look at the ocean as if it matters. It's alive. Next, please. Get out there. Swim with the whale sharks. Look at what they're eating. In a single gulp, they may take in a diversity of life as great as, in terms of the big, broad divisions of animal life on Earth. In a single mouthful, they may have a dozen or 15 phyla of animals swimming around in the plankton. Next, please. The young of starfish. Next, please. The baby crabs, they're in there, in the water. Next. And shrimp. Oh, there's so many different kinds, not just those that you see browned with butter. Next, please. A lot of little creatures that you're not likely to see because they live in burrows, may live to be 30 years, mantis shrimps. They mate for life. So why don't we respect them and learn about them? Next. And think about octopuses again as something other than something to munch on. Next, please. Squids. There's a little calamari. Next, please. It's what we're taking out of the ocean, but just as much it's what we're putting in. Of course, I come from the pre-Plasticozoic, so I can look at a scene like this and say, where did we get this idea that one-time-use plastic was a good idea? Next, please. Good news, people are responding. Next, please. It's because we now know, and we are doing things to turn things around. This is a good news story. That little turtle is free of its encumbrance and swimming again. Next. Good news, too, that now we know that, yes, fossil fuels have powered our civilization to unprecedented heights and depths. We couldn't go to the moon or Mars on whale oil. We couldn't communicate as we have, or we now do, without the special form of power, energy that we have. But now we know the best gift of all of fossil fuels has been the gift of knowledge. Now we know we have to think differently and go a different direction. Next, please. We certainly got a wake-up call last year about the real cost of cheap energy. Next, please. We can't even get down, though, to where this gusher was leaking into the Gulf of Mexico a year ago. Next, please. Because we haven't yet developed the technology that will get us readily down as much as a mile beneath the surface. There are some subs that can do it, maybe five in the world that can go that deep. Next, please. To help us evaluate, again, the real cost of what we're doing to the world. Next, please. The real cost of our appetite for so-called cheap energy. Next, please. And the next. The real cost is in terms of the changing planet that we couldn't measure going back 50 years ago. Now we can. Now we know that the planet is warming owing to the burning of fossil fuels. Next, please. With a cost to polar bears, but a cost to us here in Florida. Next, please. Sea level rise, where we're sitting right now, will be kind of wet, maybe by the end of the century. Cost to coral reefs, about half are either gone or in a state of decline, in part because of the increased warming and the acidification of the ocean is now a new specter on the horizon. Next, please. It's our time. Maybe if you had to choose a time, this is the best time ever, because now we know. Next. or at least some of us know. And it's a particular pleasure, honor for me to be here with you, because you are the conveyors of knowledge, and I hope a little slice of wisdom along with it, to be able to show that we have choices that we didn't have during previous times. Next, please. We can either watch the coral reefs from where they are today, about half are in good shape, next please, disappear before our eyes on our watch, next please. We don't have a chance with monk seals in the Caribbean or the Gulf of Mexico. They used to be here in Miami. Monk seals, unique to the Gulf and the Caribbean, all gone. There's a related species in Hawaii, another in the Mediterranean. But until 1952, there was still hope for them here. This kind of monk seal, they're gone. But we don't have to let the rest of what we now have in the treasury disappear. Next, please. This is one of the answers. It's kind of a boring slide, but think about it. Those little specks you see, those are protected areas in the sea. Taking the ethic that really began for the land early in the 20th century, and here we are early in the 21st, Laura Bush wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal that was published a few weeks ago about the opportunity that we have to do for the ocean what was done, what was initiated, what still needs to be done for the land. That it isn't just about beautiful areas because they're great for recreation, but because we like to breathe, we like to live. That these are now harbors of our life support systems, sources of restoration, of renewal. And about 14% of the land is protected, 1% of the ocean. There's an opportunity and an idea worth spreading. Next, please. To look and identify critical places. And some crafty scientists and policymakers are doing just that. It isn't just the handful that you see on this slide. There are really dozens, hundreds of places. I consider Chesapeake Bay to be a hope spot. The Gulf of Mexico, it's not perfect, but if we take action now while we still have time, there's plenty of reason for hope. Next, please. So, whether it's turtles that spin your wheels, next. Or sharks, like these 1,000 school kids in Hong Kong that I visited with in July, who have taken the pledge, protect sharks, never to eat shark fin soup, whatever it takes. Next, please. I have a vested interest. I confess, I'm biased. I have 3 kids, and I have 4 grandkids. And I'm haunted by this. And I'll leave you with this. Because I was challenged with this question myself this time last year when I gave a talk at the shipping industry in Hamburg, Germany. The whole question that was first put forward was, all right, so if you could go back 50 years, just 50 years, armed with what you now know, what we now know, what would you do differently? What would you advise the, what opportunities would you seize while there was still time? So, I think of my kids and my grandkids 50 years out, asking the question of us, armed with their knowledge, but we can't grab it. We don't have an idea. We have some clues. We don't really know what they will know. But what we do know is that we're on the edge with CO2 in the atmosphere, with the depletion of wildlife in the sea, with sharks, with the ocean acidification, and it's all happening on our watch. If ever you could choose a time to be a journalist, to be one of those rare individuals in society that conveys the news to our culture, our civilization, and provides some guidance, that should be the guiding force. What don't we know that we need to know, and what can we do now as a precautionary principle to secure an enduring future for humankind? Thank you.